the third case this morning, United States v. Barassi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Anytime a hospital employs a doctor and that doctor... I'm sorry. I didn't see Mr. Chang. Anytime a hospital employs a doctor and that doctor refers patients to the hospital, the issue in this case potentially is implicated. On one hand, the anti-kickback statute outlaws the payment of anything of value in return for referrals. On the other hand, the statute contains what the government describes as a safe harbor provision, which makes non-criminal any payments, any amount, paid pursuant to a bona fide employment relationship for the provision of services covered by Medicare. Obviously, there's a tension between these two statutes, and the issue presented in this case, at least in terms of our trial issues, relate to how to resolve this tension. It's our position that a sensible and fair way to resolve the tension is to employ the primary purpose test, requiring the jury to find that the primary purpose of the payment was for referrals as opposed to pursuant to an employment relationship.
How would that be tested? Primary purpose. It makes the payor's subjective intent dispositive with respect to the criminal liability of the recipient?
Well, it would be the overall standard would be through a jury instruction, and you'd have to evaluate the defendant's intent. What's at issue here is the intent of the defendant. The crime here is knowingly and willfully receiving payments.
Okay, but then I thought the question was the purpose of the payment.
The purpose of the payment from the perspective of the defendant. I mean, he has to have the guilty mind in order to prove the offense or the innocent mind.
Okay, so do we evaluate that in terms of the amount he's paid for legitimate services versus the amount for referrals? Well, how would that work?
That's the quagmire of this statute, because any amount that's paid for a referral is illegal, but any amount paid pursuant to an employment...
Well, that's why the other circuits have rejected that standard. So I'm trying to understand how the standard you're proposing would work.
Well, it would be through a jury instruction with the jury required to evaluate the defendant's intent based on the totality of circumstances. And evaluation of intent is something juries do every day.
Well, what you're asking the jury to do is weigh multiple purposes and decide which one is most important.
Could we be correct?
What help would you give the jury besides totality of the circumstances in answering that question?
Well, in this case, you have to look to what the defendant did. You have to look to take the employment relationship in this case. Dr. Barassi had a job description. He had an employment relationship. Beyond seeing patients at Rock Creek, he went to Rock Creek and he performed administrative services. And some of this gets to the second issue, what we couldn't get into. But he's developing protocols with nurses. He's doing employment-type functions. Even on the tapes that the government relies upon, he tells his doctors, look, you have to go to meetings. You have to do something, basically, you know, cover yourself. And he even says, I do a lot for Rock Creek beyond going and seeing patients. I work for him. He makes that statement on the tape. So you'd have to evaluate, as in any other case, what the defendant, what he did. I mean, if this was just the patients came in, he wasn't there, he didn't do anything, then it looks like the primary purpose was...
Well, suppose the evidence shows, as one might suggest here, he did a little bit, and he got a lot of money for referring patients. Do we weigh total value and say primary purpose is whichever you think more money was for?
Well, it would be up to the jury to determine the primary purpose. And looking at the intent of the payor is something that's not totally uncommon in criminal law, like an extortion statute. A person who pays money has to say, I'm afraid, or I paid because I thought I'd be...
That's a state of mind that's induced by the defendant, though, right?
Right. And here we're dealing with something... before you pose a question, I didn't think about it, but in this case, there is an element of inducement. The defendant has to induce a payment, which is induced by the referral of patients, and he has to do that knowingly and willfully. It is a difficult problem, Your Honor. It's a problem that is posed by the statute because it has this provision, this exception in it. If the statute just contained the first line, it's illegal to refer patients, then I would agree. You evaluate intent, and that's it. But it also says any payment pursuant to the contract is not illegal. Well, the government says that any amount paid is illegal. Then he's guilty. If any amount was for a referral, he's guilty. Well, why isn't the converse true? If any amount was paid pursuant to an employment contract, he's not guilty. I mean, it's a problem posed by the statute. When you're dealing with broad statutes such as this, it's not uncommon for courts to engraft a limiting principle. The Supreme Court just did that in Skilling. The mail fraud statute doesn't have materiality in it, but that's a requirement. So there has to be something to limit this statute because it's so broad, and this is what we propose. We also would suggest that the rule of lenity compels this result, and because of the ambiguity, because of the conflicting portions, and that's something the government has not responded to. If I could turn to the second, the trial issue, if there's no more questions on that, and that relates to the exclusion of evidence. One thing I want to make clear is the government tries to create the impression that, well, this really wasn't a ruling by the court, and the defense didn't object, and they got to ask about the minutes, but that's not what happened. Admittedly, this came up a number of times during the trial. The first time it came up, the government was the one who admitted these minutes pursuant to stipulation.
Yeah, I understand that they were stipulated in the evidence, but how were they authenticated? Who gave evidence that the information contained within them was accurate?
Well, they were authenticated during the testimony of Robert Mansfield, who was an officer, and they just came in pursuant to stipulation. So there
Mansfield testified that the person who made those entries had a duty to do it accurately. And
I couldn't say he did that because he kind of came in after all this. It was just a stipulation to the admission of the evidence. Authenticity wasn't questioned at that time. And then what happened was
for the use your client wanted, they had to be authentic. They had to be accurate information.
Even we had no contest that it was not accurate. We agreed it was accurate. We wanted the records and evidence.
But there was evidence that it wasn't accurately reporting what happened.
Well, what happened was... Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Baig testified. He was a little bit of a willy witness, but he testified, well, I didn't sign those. I can't say. I don't remember if I was there, things to that effect. And he stepped away from the records, and the cross-examination of him on that point was not effective. But then when the Mamoon testified, and she was the CEO during the entire time frame, and she certainly authenticated these records. So if there's a question as to authentication, comes in through Wendy Mamoon. But the distinction that needs to be made here is attendance at a meeting and doing work. And what we were precluded from showing was that the integrated doctors and Dr. Barassi performed work, and that was in the minutes. The district court made...
Can you direct us to an example? I've got to say, I was having trouble from the briefs understanding exactly what was excluded, and in particular, whether what was excluded was another layer of hearsay.
What was excluded was the district court precluded the defense from arguing the substance of the minutes. So in other words, you could ask a witness, did a doctor attend a meeting? Yes, but that was it. You couldn't go beyond that. We couldn't go into what occurred at the meetings, what was discussed at the meetings.
Well, okay. Give me an example. Where do we find it in the record of some critical evidence that would have supported your defense that you weren't allowed to get into?
Just before I answer that, I'm going to answer it. When the district court denied the motion for new trial, and it's attached to our required short appendix, he said what I precluded here was the substance of the minutes. That was precluded on hearsay grounds. So he understood his rulings to be that. At pages 1974 and 1975 of the record, which are included in our supplemental appendix at pages 32 and 33, an offer of proof of sorts is made regarding the substance of what was in the minutes. And it talked about the things that Dr. Barassi did beyond attending the meetings. Worked on IV and NG tubes. He developed protocols. He did things in response to his various committee memberships. And that's listed. And there's a number of medical terms. But that's where it's at.
Okay. And I guess I'm concerned, for example, 921, Barassi worked with Garcia and Leeds, IVs and NG tubes. Okay? That's something that the minutes reported?
Yes.
That somebody said in the meeting?
It was discussed in the meeting.
Okay. Yeah. So in the meeting minutes say, we talked about the work Barassi did, right?
That's correct.
Okay. I think you run into a second layer of hearsay then, and Judge Hibbler had it exactly right. Because we say the minutes come in as business records to say, where they say the following people were at the meeting, the committee took the following actions, here were the votes, etc. But when you get further into assertions, not that the minutes make, but assertions that are reported, it's an extra layer, right?
Well, in my response to that is it's a layer of hearsay that occurs in the context of business records.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
If as here, the minutes say doctors X, Y, and Z were at the meeting. Okay, you can use the business record exception to use the minutes to prove the doctors X, Y, and Z were at the meeting. I think we're all in agreement about that, right?
Yes, sir.
Suppose the minutes say Dr. Z said it was raining outside during the meeting. Can you use the minutes to prove that it was in fact raining, or is that an extra layer of hearsay?
Well, if the distinction there is that that's a discussion about an event that really doesn't relate to the purpose of the business, I would think.
Well, suppose that the minutes report that Dr. Jones said he's been working nonstop on Art Rock Creek business.
Okay.
Can you use the minutes to prove that what he said in the meeting was true?
We would say yes, Your Honor, because this is a statement within the context of business by people who are employed by the business. These aren't statements of outsiders coming in. If a third party had come in and made statements, I would agree. That would be a statement of an outsider that's not covered by the business records exception. But what the business record exception covers are statements made by people who are working in that business. Here, a hospital, doctors, employees of the hospital. So that's the distinction. If it's an outsider statement, hearsay. If it's a statement of a party within a business, it's our position it's not hearsay. And we've cited cases that have discussed that in the brief. So, I see I'm into my rebuttal time, and I don't want to leave without talking about the sentence, if I could. Just stated simply, it just looks like there were two different standards employed in this case. Dr. Barassi, who is underneath the head of the whole hospital, who doesn't get charged, his in-house counsel, who's in on all this, who doesn't get charged, and the CEO, who was involved in efforts to get patients into the hospital well before Dr. Barassi arrived on the scene. Well, Dr. Barassi gets the 4-point enhancement for leadership. The CEO only gets a 2-point enhancement for leadership. The judge says, well, I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt. Well, isn't Dr. Barassi entitled to the benefit of the doubt? If you look at the length of sentence, you see the same thing. Dr. Barassi received a sentence which was 1,200% greater than the CEO. They both went to trial. They both had similar criminal records. They both were around the same age. And they were convicted of the very same offenses.
Ms. Mamoun had some some extraordinary personal circumstances.
She did have extraordinary personal circumstances, and I'm not diminishing that, but Dr. Barassi also had personal circumstances. He has a 2.5-year-old child. The judge said, yes, a child needs the nature of his father, that kind of thing, just as Ms. Mamoon's child needed her care. What I'm saying is
specialized care, though, after a severe accident.
That's true. I'm not doubting that at all. All I'm saying is the weight that was applied in that case brings the sentence way down, and the weight that was applied in our case doesn't. And if you just look at this from Dr. Barassi's perspective, I mean, he's in jail for 6 years, and his co-defendant gets 6 months, and that just is a disparate sentence under the statute. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Grohman?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I am Christopher Grohman on behalf of the United States. The Medicare kickback statute makes it illegal to receive any remuneration in exchange for impermissible referrals. Subsection B3B simply reiterates that to the extent that a doctor is receiving compensation for the provision of covered items or services, the money he receives for that is perfectly lawful. The key phrase is, for the provision of covered items or services. These impermissible referrals are not covered items or services. And this distinction is important because lots of times the doctors that are doing these impermissible referrals are also working as an adjunct medical provider or as an administrator to the hospital. So lots of times they are, in fact, giving legitimate medical or administrative services. The provision says, to the extent that they receive money for the provision of those lawful services, that's fine. That's a salary for legitimate services. But separate and apart from that, to the extent that they get paid for the referrals, it's unlawful under the statute. Four other circuits have already held that there is no conflict here, that the primary purpose standard does not apply. And as Judge Hamilton pointed out, the primary purpose standard is essentially unworkable. Let's say that a doctor gets a salary of $100,000 a year, and $75,000 of that is for medical services that he provides to a patient, but $25,000 of that is for these unlawful referrals. Well, 75% of that money is for legitimate services. Does that mean that he skates on the $25,000 bribe that he receives? The better way to think about it is, you know, $75,000 is fine, but 100% of the money that he receives above that is a bribe. A bribe is a bribe is a bribe. So to the extent that he receives any payment as a bribe, he is guilty under the Medicare kickback statute.
How did you distinguish the money for legitimate services and those for providing patients?
Here, Your Honor, the government argued that 100% of Mr. Barassi's administrative contract, as well as 100% of his subordinates' administrative contracts, were bribes. I think I want to make one point. To the extent that Dr. Barassi or his physicians went to Rock Creek and performed medical tests or medical exams on the patients, he billed Medicare separately for that. The amount that integrated physicians billed Medicare was approximately $10.7 million. The government did not argue that this $10.7 million, we didn't argue that as loss amount, we didn't argue that as a bribe. We just said the kickbacks and the bribes in this were the administrative contracts, the amount he received pursuant to these fake contracts.
Administration rather than medical services.
Yes, the contracts that were drawn up as a cover here said Dr. Barassi will receive $100,000 a year for administrative services, which, you know, sitting on a board doing these reports. That was what we said was the bribe at trial. Separate and apart from that, Dr. Barassi, after he referred a patient, he'd show up, he'd perform a test, which the government argued at sentencing were often unnecessary tests. and he would bill Medicare separately from that. So he's essentially getting paid twice for the same patient. Turning to the business meeting minutes, the defendant was not prevented from using the business meeting minutes, even the substance of the business meeting minutes. When defense counsel first brought up wanting to use these minutes was during the direct of Ms. Mamoun, and what he was seeking to introduce was not actually the minutes themselves, but reports that were attached to the meeting minutes. And as Judge Hibbler correctly held, that these reports were hearsay. That's what he said to defense counsel, and if defense counsel wanted to say, well, those reports themselves are business records, it had the opportunity to do so or try to come up with some other exception to the hearsay rule, but they didn't. And
these are not reports of the meetings. These are reports submitted to the
meetings. Yes, Your Honor. When they first tried to introduce them, what they were trying to introduce was two reports from Dr. Singla. During one of the main meetings, Ms. Mamoun, who was the head of that meeting, took into the meeting minutes these reports that Dr. Singla did as part of a subcommittee. It was called the Peer Review Committee. And the meeting minutes said, Dr. Singla submitted two reports pursuant to his duties as peer review. And they were attached to the minutes. And that's, Judge Hibbler said, okay, you want to use the minutes. I want to rule on a question-by-question basis. You can have a recess if you want me to rule on everything ahead of time. And then defense counsel said, well, you know, I want to use these two reports that were attached to the meeting minutes. And then the district court said, no, those two reports are hearsay. And that sort of ended the discussion then. Later on, they were trying to, again, use those reports, again, trying to use, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, some of the meeting minutes that were themselves hearsay. And the judge said, the judge excluded these because they were hearsay. And defense counsel never proffered an argument as to why they were not hearsay. And in any event, they got everything they wanted to get from these minutes in through the questioning of the four doctors that took the stand, through the questioning of Mr. Baeg, through the questioning of Ms. Mamoun. They literally stood up there with the meeting minutes and say, you know, was this report submitted? Did this report say this? They essentially did an end run around the district court's ruling anyway.
Did you object?
No, we did. The government did not object. It could have. It chose not to. And as another layer of harmless error, the evidence in this case is overwhelming. Mr. Barassi is on at least 8 different recorded calls saying, oh, we don't do any work. We just show up to do the minimum amount of work to make it look like these aren't completely bribes to the public. Turning now to the sentencing, there was a disparity in sentencing in this case. However, as Judge Tenure pointed out, a lot of that disparity had to come from the fact that, well within the district court's discretion under the 3553A factors, Judge Hibbler gave some weight to Ms. Mamoun's family situation, and he chose not to give the same weight to Defendant Barassi's argument. And that is well within the district court's discretion. There was 2 days worth of sentencing hearing on this. Judge Hibbler talked at length about each of the factors. The record supports that he made a well-considered decision under the 3553A factors.
How many defendants were there in this?
There was 3 defendants in this originally. There was Ms. Mamoun, who was the CEO, who received 6 months plus a year home confinement plus 5 years of supervised release. There's Dr. Barassi, who received 72 months imprisonment, which was 6 months under the guideline range. And then there was Mr. Baeg, who is the CFO. He pled guilty and was sentenced after trial, and he received 15 months. However, his offense level was about half that of some of the other defendants. And if there's no further questions.
What about the loss calculation?
Turning to the loss calculation, all that is required of a district court is that it give a reasonable estimate. And as this court said in United States versus Peterson Knox, in order to find that a loss calculation constitutes clear error, it not only has to be inaccurate, but it has to be outside the realm of all possible computation. The credit Dr. Barassi got here was overly generous. $150,000 was well more than the record supported. The government argued that he should get zero credit. The substance that Judge Hibbler pointed to in giving this $150,000 credit was a 24-hour on-call service that Dr. Barassi and the integrated physicians had for his patients. However, that was actually a boon to Dr. Barassi. All physicians were required to have on-call services for their patients. However, to the extent that their beeper went off and they had to go in to service a patient, they billed Medicare for that. So the on-call service actually gave Dr. Barassi an exclusive right to go and bill. Government argues that that service is of no value to Rock Creek, and certainly not in the amount that it was credited for.
Well, when you were distinguishing between legitimate services and those that were for referrals, did that come into play in Judge Hibbler's calculation of the loss?
Well, to the extent that he was paid for, Judge Hibbler made a finding that he did give some value to the hospital, and he said that some of the value was his participation on the committees and that a lot of the value came from this on-call service that he set up. And then he gave Dr. Barassi this $150,000 set-off against the loss amount, which he thought was an accurate estimate of the value that Dr. Barassi provided to Rock Creek. And that changed the restitution amount, but as Judge Hibbler said, it didn't change the offense level.
Could I ask you one last question going back to the minutes and the hearsay issues there? The what we call the business record exception, 8036, includes a kind of last-minute escape hatch for what would otherwise be admissible business records. Unless the source of information or the method or circumstances of preparation indicate lack of trustworthiness. Did the district court ever address that issue in dealing with the minutes or hearsay issues here?
No, Your Honor. The district court made its finding based on hearsay.
Just hearsay with
yes,
hearsay.
Yes. The minutes, it's because that when the district court was first presented with this objection, it's the reports. It's not the minutes that the defendant was trying to use. It was the reports that was attached to the minutes. And those are, not only are they not authenticated, but...
Those are about three layers. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. And defendant could have tried to say, well, okay, we have the minutes which are in evidence, but these reports are business records which are attached to something in evidence, and then the government would have gotten into the authentication issues, reliability issues, but that never
came
up. Based
on the recordings, I gather there was, at least from your perspective, plenty of reason to doubt the trustworthiness of some of those reports.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, Ms. Mamoon is the one who prepared the minutes. The recordings show that Dr. Barassi instructed the other doctors to do things to make it appear as though they were actually doing work. So there would have been a lot of problems with that. And for these reasons, we ask this court to affirm defendant's conviction and his sentence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. I'll give you two more minutes, Mr. Carr, if you...
Your Honor, regarding the minutes, I think the government sets up a straw man argument with these reports. The issue here was the substance of the minutes. We didn't object on appeal to some report that it's talking about. These minutes are actually in the record. They were defendants' exhibits 80 and 81, and they were filed.
Those went to the jury, right?
The minutes did go to the jury. But defense counsel was precluded from saying, if you look at the minutes for this particular date, it shows that Dr. Barassi attended the meeting and explained how he's developing a protocol for IVs of patients, et cetera, et cetera. On the sentencing, I need to make clear here what we're contesting is the adequacy of Judge Hibbler's findings on the loss. We don't get to the ultimate question, was it the correct amount? It's the adequacy of the findings. And if you look at the record, he picked out this number and didn't explain the basis for it. He said, I'm going to give some credit for on-call services. He didn't say how he was doing it, for what period of time, what the hourly rate would be, et cetera, et cetera. He said the administrative services were of some value, but he didn't quantify it. So this court really can't review that because he just made a generalized conclusory finding.
How could he do better?
Well, you could say that I find that during the period of the offense that there was so many hours of on-call service.
When the activity was fraudulent, it's pretty hard to make a line-by-line accurate estimate.
It's our position that not all, in light of the conviction, not all the activity was fraudulent, that there was work performed. There, with respect to
this, it's all the more difficult.
Go ahead. Sorry.
It makes all the more difficult.
And a judge did say it was a difficult task, and I agree it's a difficult task, but there has to be something there that this court can look to and review.
What concerns me is that if he came in and said, I'm going to give you credit for $10 an hour of on-call service, you'd come in and say, well, it was an arbitrary number. I don't know how the judge is supposed to do better.
Just explain the basis for his findings rather than just picking out a number is our position. Thank you for the extra time.
Barton, were you and Mr. Jensen appointed?
We were, Your Honor.
You have the appreciation of the court for the very good representation here.
Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement.